And welcome again. This is Mitchell Warren from AVAC, and really delighted to welcome you all onto today's call, which is an exciting one on a lot of levels. A number of you on the line who we'll hear from shortly were in Cape Town last week for the first ever HIV Research for Prevention Conference. And we had actually put this in the calendar already before the conference, not knowing how the conference would go, but we really wanted a chance for fairly rapid feedback to those not at the conference on what were the major items of interest and questions and themes that emerged. And for those of you who were at the conference as well, a chance to debrief together. And really, as we described in the title of the email, the road from R4P, both for the field over the next couple of years in terms of the substance that will be done by researchers and advocates and policymakers, but also thinking even a bit to the conference to be held now in 2016. So I'm looking forward to hearing from all sorts of people about what were the big takeaways from the meeting. The format for today, I hope, is relatively straightforward. We are in global mute to at least start, given a number of people and wanting to keep the line clear so that we can record it. Emily Bass from AVAC and I are going to briefly go through a couple of slides just to orient folks, particularly those who weren't at the conference, about the conference and some of the main themes, at least from where we were sitting. And then we've asked a few of you who were at the conference to make yourselves available, and I'll ask a few questions just to kind of get the conversation going about some of the key themes and some of the major messages there. And then we'll open it up for questions. And as ever, feel free to email at avac@avac.org or use the ReadyTalk post system, or we'll open the lines and you can hit *7 to unmute yourself and ask any questions. So that is the plan for today, and hopefully it's a conversation that will continue well beyond today's call. As many of you know, hopefully as all of you know, you wouldn't be on the call, last week was the first ever HIV Research for Prevention conference that emerged over a number of years of conversations amongst civil society, researchers, policymakers, and funders about a conference that would bring together all of the different prevention research modalities. And I just put this slide up to orient you. And we'll talk a bit about a number of important sessions and conversations that were there. And I highly recommend the HIVR4P.org website has the webcast feature. There's a link at the end of this presentation as well. And almost all of the sessions and presentations are available via webcast. And I think it's a great way for people who weren't at the conference at all to really hear and see what was going on. And I know for many people who even were there, the webcast provided a great opportunity for checking back in on sessions you missed or sessions you just want more of. In addition, you'll see the hashtag, because we do live in a new age of social media, that if you do go to Twitter or, I believe, Facebook and do the hashtag HIVR4P, you can see some of the conversations that were emerging in real time. And it actually does make for interesting reading, I think, to see what were the conversations and how things were unfolding. So certainly recommend all of that to folks to take advantage of. Again, these are borrowed from the conference secretariat and the conference chairs, just to give people a sense. And you know, when this was first thought of several years ago, the idea was likely to bring somewhere between 1,200 and 1,500 people to the first ever conference. Amazingly enough, 1,350, so spot on between the 1,200 and 1,500 mark, attended from 48 countries, 6 continents. 300 scholarships were awarded, which is a great testament to support from funders that provided for that, and I think really strengthened the conference. And I'll show you the breakdown in terms of where those scholars came from, but it really did highlight young investigators and advocates and journalists coming particularly from low and middle income countries. So it really did provide a truly international meeting, although it was taking place in Cape Town, South Africa. There were 722 abstracts presented, 30% of them by African researchers. And that is not just because it was in Cape Town. I think it really speaks to the growing strength and globalization and diversity of our fields. And that, I think, is a super exciting element. And again, you can see the breakdown there. The whole program, as I said, is on the session, and then you see a bullet repeated. But again, the webcast address there from the HIV R4P website to see any of them. And I think a number of the people who we'll ask questions of on this call, one of the questions is, you know, if you have limited time, which sessions would you recommend people watching? So for those of you who are about to answer questions, you can be prepared with your favorite for your favorite webcast. And then just to give you a sense of the scholarships, because I think it did really highlight the diversity of the field, 200 full scholarships, 100 partials, and 28 journalists. And you can see that just over half were from Africa, and I think really strengthened the overall feeling of the conference. I will also say, and there's a slide at the very end just of some resources and web links, the journalist program, which was a combination of the past vaccine conferences and past microbicide conferences, really an attempt to bring together and both support and brief journalists in advance of the conference and then support them throughout the conference, really paid off. I think if you go to the web link that you'll see at the end of the clips that have already been emerging from the conference, I think it is some of the most accurate and high-quality journalism that you'll see. And that is not a coincidence. It really is a testament to the strength of that program. And again, you'll see that emerging if you go to some of the articles and see what people were writing. And I think that's really an important component of the project. That's kind of the logistics of the conference. I'm going to now turn it over to Emily Bass. And, you know, I think most of you probably know that many of the things that AVAC writes, most if not all of the things AVAC writes, come from Emily's pen in the old school tradition. And hopefully many of you will have seen the daily summaries that we were putting out from Cape Town. And again, Emily led the writing and editing of that. And so really did have a bird's eye view of all the comings and goings. And I'll turn it over to her to give you a quick sense of what some of the emerging themes of the conference were, at least from our perspective.
Great. I can't control the slides. I think
that's okay.
To the next one. There we go. All right. So, hi, everybody. I'm excited for this call and this conversation because it was an exciting meeting. And I thought the first thing I would do is just do my version of the conference themes, not in my own words, but in participants' words. Several of the quotes are people quoting other people, so their own or borrowed words. Because these lines stood out in my head a week later when I was thinking about this, and then I'll do one slide that's a little bit less quotey, just to focus on some themes, and then I hope we can really talk about it. So the first quote, "Success is not final, failure is not fatal, it's the courage to continue that counts," came from Gino Marazzo from the University of Washington, by way of Winston Churchill, in a discussion of what we learned about trial conduct and in a series of sessions, many of which are mentioned in the daily summaries that Mitchell mentioned, and with the names and numbers, you can tie them back to webcast links. And the thread there was really trying to understand what happened in the VOICE trial, which was looking at oral and topical tenofovir-based PrEP, and women in the trial did not use the products enough, adherence was low, to get a clear answer about whether they worked, but they also didn't talk about the fact that they weren't using it. And so that really raised a lot of questions, many of which we actually grappled with last year in our AVAC report, if you want to get more reading material, about what we do and don't know as communities of researchers, of trial participants, of advocates, about what's happening in research. And VOICE-D was the protocol launched after the trial stopped, for lack of efficacy, or stopped providing product, to try to understand what happened. And there were a lot of sessions, and it's difficult because one wants a trial to succeed, one wants a clear answer, whether that's efficacy or not. But out of the difficulty emerged some really rich, ongoing threads about trust, about communication, about motivation, about how we define what is and isn't disclosed, and I'll loop down to Yvette Raphael's quote at the bottom in a few moments, just to sort of bring us full circle. But I would say that one of the main themes from HIV R4P that resonates beyond microbicide research really is the field continuing to grapple with how we conduct clinical trials, how we work in partnership, what that means, who the we is in that sentence, with really important, if difficult, lessons coming from VoiceD. Next quote, all breakthrough and no follow-through, also a borrowed quote, and one that I love, from Glenda Gray, with multiple affiliations, including the Perinatal HIV Research Unit, the South African Medical Research Council, and HVTN. Again, a highlighted session in the daily summaries from the final day, talking about the potential enormous waste of the resources that we put into research if we don't deliver what has been proven to work. And I think that is another theme that resonated in different ways throughout the conference as we looked at daily oral PrEP, as we looked at the idea of treatment as prevention and what we're learning from early trials, as we thought forward to what it would take to implement a vaginal microbicide or a ring, that there is a gap between what the science is showing us is possible to do and what there is both financial and programmatic resources at this point committed to. And I think that where this wasn't said explicitly, I think the question is there in the sense it was a very exciting meeting on a lot of fronts scientifically, and we have to raise that question even if the presenters delivering the exciting science aren't, is, okay, great, this sounds really promising, but what is going to turn it into impact? So that was another theme, both explicit and implicit, as we heard about advances in the context of constrained resources. There's a quote that I didn't put up from Robin Shattuck, also one of the conference co-chairs from the closing session, talking about how this is the best and worst of times, which is the other side of the coin from Glenda's quote, in the sense that we have tremendous breakthroughs and limited resources, and that's falling HIV research prevention research funding, which you can see at HIVResourceTracking.org if you want yet more reading, as well as PEPFAR flat funding and an unfunded global fund. And together you really have the conditions for all breakthrough and no follow-through, as Glenda said. HIV anywhere is HIV everywhere. Another borrowed quote, originally spoken about tuberculosis. This is from Chris Byrer at Johns Hopkins University, in a really elegant and eloquent and impassioned talk on the need to be diligent and responsive and rights-based. That if we deliver our best interventions and do not deliver them to groups that are hard to reach because they're hard to see, because they fear coming into medical clinics, perhaps, because there are laws against their behavior, their identities, we're not going to have an effective HIV response. And I think that the theme here of aligning rights and science, so not just doing human rights in one realm and then delivering the science or doing the science in the other, but linking them up and figuring out how to do that at a moment when there seems to be, and I would love to talk about this a bit on the call, there seems to be more of a gap than there may have been in at other points in the epidemic between what the science says and where the rights-based conversations are going. How do we bring those together? It's the cute little Texas laboratory opossum. One of my favorite things about this conference was being able to run from, I think Mitchell said, the bird's eye view. It was mostly the stair eye view or the escalator eye view, running from one session to another, trying to get a full picture and leaving a session on the ways that women talked about anal sex in the VOICE trial, another session that we mentioned in the daily summary, and running down to a session on B cells, which are the cells that give rise to antibodies. Antibodies are a potent immune response that can be harnessed to block infection and that are part of what makes most vaccines that do work for us right now effective. And there's a lot of very exciting research happening in the antibody field, and a lot of it is very highly technical. And there are many advocates who are actually more fluent in this science than I am. And there are also many advocates who are fluent in a lot of things who can't really follow the B-cell stuff. And so I put this quote in from Garnett Kelso. There's a fascinating set of facts in the presentation that is also highlighted in the daily summary about the genetic uniqueness of opossums and zebrafish, which I will leave you to discover. But I put the quote in there as a placeholder highlight the fact that what was happening in the antibody sessions was very exciting and very interesting. And while not necessarily lending itself to concrete civil society advocacy in the way that, say, preparing for microbicide delivery does, that it's important for us to think about how we do hold in our heads some sense of what these breakthroughs with the opossums mean and what it means that we are now learning with increasing specificity and clarity how an antibody goes from being in its naive or its germline state to being a highly developed HIV-specific potent antibody. There are a set of steps along the way, and we need to understand those steps if we're going to make a vaccine that induces those antibodies. And so mapping those steps and then tracking how those relate to the way that HIV changes in the body is happening with more and more precision. And I think capturing a sense of these increments and what they mean and carrying a bit of that excitement is something that is a challenge for all of us, but also an important thing to do because there is movement as technical as it is. And so that for me was another theme. The movement, it was exciting as, again, I said, not a super fluent person to sit in these sessions and really begin to see that there are pieces coming into place that we really are moving towards a sense of how to build a broadly neutralizing antibody based vaccine, but also how to test these antibodies directly in passive immunization trials. I don't have a quote up here about HIV vaccine trials that are following on from the Thai Prime Boost trial, which will probably be happening in South Africa, but that was another exciting area, and I know we'll get to that in the discussion. And then the final quote, looping back to the beginning and sort of connecting the dots, is we don't lie as a choice but as a negotiation. And this is from Yvette Raphael, who is an amazing advocate and activist. She is also a terrific writer. I really recommend checking out the What's Up HIV blog, which was a live blog at the conference. Yvette contributed, and this is a line from that blog. And it connects to the first quote in the sense that the way that we talked about or the way that the conversations about women participants' disclosure of their product use or non-disclosure of their product use, but low product adherence. The shorthand for that sometimes and often very sensitively was lying. Why did women lie about product use? And I think that this was a conference where there was so much information, both in terms of data, but in terms of how we talked about things, and that people were listening very closely. There were amazing advocates in civil society, and there were amazing scientist advocates, and we were all, I think, really listening to each other. And Yvette's blog and this quote sort of indicate that as much as, again, I will say, sort of talking about why women might lie or women might not disclose was done in a way that really foregrounded what research doesn't understand about participants, that we really need to understand the perspective from the women that a term like lying may not encompass the reality that's going on. It may not encompass all of the contingencies that lead to someone needing to stay in a trial to get the best health care she can get, and that we need a common language, really, I think, that feels accurate to everybody involved. And so I really loved Yvette at the conference and this quote for sort of pushing that. And I think that this theme of language is another one and that resonates, because what other tool do we have really to talk about scientific breakthroughs except language and challenges except language that has to be respectful and accurate and shared. So those are sort of my themes and words. And then this is it in bullet points. I don't think that I really need to go through this again. I actually think I said I was afraid that I was going to get so hung up on the opossums that I wasn't going to get to this. But you can see it here. I think that we've learned a lot. I think in terms of themes and things that you can either go back through in the webcasts, in the blogs, in the summaries, or add to if you were there and you think I've really missed something. I think it's this real sense of being in a very dynamic, if difficult, moment of learning about research. The one thing that, or we're learning about women and prevention and research, but the one thing that I did not actually put here in that first bullet that I do want to add is that at the same time that we were talking about VoiceD and many sessions and why women didn't use the product in clinical trials, there was a really strong and clear demand for an interest in information on daily oral PrEP in young women and women. And I think that one of the things that I remember really clearly in a discussion that happened in the Advocates Corner, which was a vibrant space where folks got together to talk about what they were hearing and have additional conversations within a young women's or women's leadership lunch that happened on the Thursday, a conversation about what women didn't use in the trials where they didn't use products of FemPrep and Voice. And it wasn't they didn't use tenofovir-based PrEP. It was they didn't use a product that they didn't know what it was, right, because everyone's counseled in a trial that we don't know whether this is effective and we don't know whether you've gotten a placebo. And that even as Voice was telling us what we don't understand about adherence and disclosure and conversations and trials, what women were saying in the Advocates Corner, in sessions, in hallway chat, that we want to know where the investigation of daily oral PrEP is for young women. And I'll tell you where it isn't. It isn't in a full suite of demonstration projects right now, and young women have noticed that. And I think that we need to, as we understand what a trial that has low adherence tells us, we also need to understand that it does not tell us that the people in the trial do not want the product now that efficacy is proven. So that's a little addition to that bullet. I talked about the progress. It's exciting. Some of it's long-term. Some of it's coming soon to a clinical trial, possibly near you. We need to turn innovation into impact. We need to integrate or reintegrate health and human rights agendas, and there's just a long way to go in connecting research to the many realities of people, many people, including women and girls, but not exclusively. So those are my themes. And I'm going to turn it back over to Mitchell because I think everybody had a different conference. That's another great thing about this meeting is that there were so many different ways to follow sessions that you could have been in the same building and had a completely different experience. So, Mitchell, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Fabulous. Emily, thank you so much. And I am going to ask some specific questions of a few of you on the line and certainly want to welcome others who were at the conference or following it from afar to identify things that were discussed that maybe weren't on Emily's summary. But let me start actually with a longtime advocate and friend, Steve Wakefield, at the HIV Vaccine Trials Network. Wakefield, if you're not unmuted, you can hit *7 to unmute yourself.
I think I've done that.
I hear you. That's wonderful. So I wanted to start. Emily described a lot of the interest in the hallways on the vaccine side was around updates on some of the antibody work. But we often were hearing in the conference and reported in the daily summaries that an efficacy trial or trials are perhaps a step closer now after the R4P meeting based on data presented there. And I wondered if you could give us a sense of why we're a step closer after last week.
Well, I don't know if we're so much as I would say we're a step closer as much as, at least because I'm in the trenches every day, but I think that what I certainly can say is we know we've been going the right direction. One of the really important things that happened at the conference for me, there was an announcement of the results of HVT and 097. And this was a time when the first time the vaccine regimen that had been used in Thailand, in the Thai trial where we had a 31% efficacy, was tested in Africa on Africans. So we went from a clay E region to a clade C region with the same product, and we found that we have results where we were able to elicit a similar response. We found a robust response, as robust a response in Africans as we had found in Thais. And what worked for me and the rest of the conference around that was as we looked at what we're doing in HIV vaccine research, the great amount of new knowledge we have about how a vaccine works, what we did about correlates of protection is we were able to see a lot of data in this particular conference where the things that we've been doing in terms of correlates of protection and the way we've designed future trials confirm that we're going in the right direction. Decisions we were making 4 and 5 years ago without data, we now have clinical trials data to tell us keep going, that you're going the right way, and you might be able to get an answer. That said, I think one of the most important plenaries for me to answer your other question, Mitchell, which was about sessions that we think people should watch, is I would encourage people to watch the closing plenary, which was called Mind the Gap, Bridging from Trial Success to Access. And in that particular plenary, there were two presentations, one by Glenda Gray, where she really took a good look at what we've learned from PrEP and PEP in the various vaccine studies, but also by Alex Patinho, who hasn't been introduced in this session, who's on the board of IAVI, where he talked about scaling up HIV prevention science from laboratory to the village. And he really gave what was, for me, was an engaging talk about moving from efficacy to effectiveness and knowing what works and taking a hard look at all of what we do. He was really clever. At the beginning, he started out by showing a picture of his son as an infant, who I think his son is now 28 or 30 years old, and saying that when he was first doing work, and at the time he was holding that infant son, people were saying, we're 10 years away from an HIV vaccine. And he felt that people were still saying, we're 10 years away from an HIV vaccine. And showed a picture of his son with his other siblings in college, who are at college living in Portland, in their late 20s and early 30s. But what he did was talk about the importance of using everything we know as fast as we know it and having plans to implement and utilize the tools we have in a successful manner, and that we need to do a better job of planning for success. Now, it was the end of the conference. Those were ongoing themes I heard all throughout the conferences. We've got tools. We've got to use the tools we have now. We can't give up on a future that's better, but we've got to find ways to incorporate and use all the tools we have for now. And that was one of the most important talks for me at the conference, and it was right at the end of the meeting.
Great. Thanks, Wick. You're right, and any presentation at the end of a meeting has a high bar to keep people engaged, and Alex certainly did that. So that's incredibly helpful. And it actually is a great segue in, and Sheena McCormick, I think you're on if you want to hit *7. But to Wakefield's point and to Alex's point about using what we have and acting on evidence quickly, I think there's no better example than the conversations happening throughout the conference about data that actually wasn't even presented at the conference. And I think just before the conference, a couple of weeks before, Sheena, who leads the PROUD study, provided a really important update just before the conference. And then while we were all sitting in listening actually to the opening plenary talk by Jared Baton, the French ANRS team running the IPERGAY study on PrEP announced that they were shifting the trial. But I wonder, Sheen, if you want to reflect on all of that, even though the data is not yet available for either PROUD or IPERGAY, will only be available at CROI, we're told, in the first quarter. How do you think these findings and all of those discussions last week about PrEP might change or should change the conversations we're having about PrEP and where we should be going?
Thanks, Mitchell. Can you hear me?
Yes, absolutely.
Great. I'm not sure quite where to start, but I think, you know, obviously when for our announcement and for what was happening in PROUD, you know, we knew that this was the important evidence we had to collect in the UK, because there was a concern that if you gave people a tablet that was now known to be effective, so picking up on what Emily was saying about the women in Advocates' corner in those placebo-controlled trials, you know, people didn't know what they were getting, and particularly not in the first vanguard of trials in IPEX, for example, it wasn't even known that PrEP would work. And I think that's a really important thing that sometimes does get lost in translation. You can't apply behavior in a placebo-controlled trial to the real world. And that was very, very strongly recognized by the entire range of UK stakeholders, and it brought with it a concern that people using an alternative, what could be seen as an alternative to condoms, might then increase their condomless sex partners, and that could end up meaning an increased risk of exposure to the very high levels of viral load that we see in seroconversion. So people might increase their risk of exposure to very infectious individuals, and maybe it won't work that well in those circumstances. And that's why we set out to do PROUD. It was a really important result for us. And I think maybe perhaps a bit naively, we hadn't appreciated that it would have a much broader impact, and it would be seen as very useful in a much broader context. And I think the messages that I took home from the conference probably came out of Connie's presentation in a diffusion of innovation session, where she was saying it's so important to think of your studies in the context of how you would see this in implementation. So another bullet Emily had was about that we're a long way from implementation, all these fantastic tools, but long way from getting them to people that need them. And I think that we have designed research studies that look very different to the real world, with very frequent visits, very intense follow-up, and very, very intense packages of risk reduction. In a setting in developing countries, in resource-limited countries, that just isn't what it looks like in the clinic. Now, we're very privileged in the UK to have this sexual health network, so we genuinely were able to do a study that looks like a PrEP program will look like in the UK. So, I mean, obviously, that was something we already knew, but I don't think that was served to the rest of the world. And I felt that was something that we had, that we'd been able to sort of help by demonstrating. But actually, it doesn't have to be difficult. It really doesn't have to be difficult. You have to find that people are already going to get HIV testing and sexual health screening, and that's where you deliver the new tools to reduce their risk of HIV. So that, I guess, is my take. And then, of course, it's incredibly exciting to have two European studies, you know, both coming up with an early result. We've been very slow to come to the table in Europe, and it's, you know, and that's meant we kind of felt a long way behind. But I think a difference I would like to think is that we'll be able to accelerate a little bit more quickly now. But that remains to be seen, obviously, and it will vary tremendously from country to country. If I could just make one more point, I think the thing that I took home and that really struck me was how far the US has still got to go in so many ways, and how difficult it is for people in America, you know, to sort of have, well, to achieve equitable access is incredibly difficult. I was really shocked by how unavailable free post-exposure prophylaxis is across the states in America. And I think it's something we inside America, you know, it sort of looks like PrEP's been rolled out, but it's a long way from the truth.
Yeah, no, it's a great point, Sheena. And in that diffusion of innovation session, and we'll send an email follow-up to people on the webinar and highlight some of these sessions, but Sheena mentioned Connie's presentation. Keith Rawlings from Gilead presented an update on the U.S. that was certainly better than some of the data he presented a couple of years ago, but still is, as Sheena points out, a very long way to go. And it'll be very interesting, actually, following after Tuesday's election to see what happens next. But that's super helpful, Sheena. And I want to turn next, and you heard her name already mentioned by Emily, but to Yvette Raphael in South Africa. Because because of the recent Proud and IPRGay announcements, there was a lot of talk about PrEP and MSM, and rightly so. But it wasn't just about PrEP and MSM in Cape Town. And I wonder, Yvette, if you're there and can give a sense of what it was like in the Advocates Corner and in the conversations about where PrEP might or might not fit in the lives of young African women. Yvette, are you there? You can hit star 7. All right. Well, while we try to get Yvette, let me turn then to Tricia from Kenya, another fabulous leading women's health advocate and voice around these issues. And I wonder, perhaps asking you somewhat the same question, Tricia, if you could describe a bit of the conversations about where the research that was emerging in Cape Town, where does it fit into the conversations that you're leading and engaged with for women in Africa? And Tracy, you can hit star 7, and I'm going to try. Can we unmute you? I can see you on the list there. Tracy?
Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, go ahead. Wonderful.
Hi, this is Tracy. Yeah, like anyway, I thought the conference was quite an eye-opener for me, being the first conference talking about HIV prevention. And this gave me an opportunity not only to learn, but also to fill in the missing gaps that I've been having as I read through the HIV prevention agenda. And one of the key areas that really came out directly to me is that we have to deliver what has been developed, and that was quite key. And so as we need to combat misinformation and also address the human rights issues and training of health workers to ensure that the work that the researchers are doing are also reached to the population and community that need them most. And so as an advocate, even during the Advocate Corner and various sessions that we had, really my work was sort of like refining, seeing various ways that I can work with the policymakers, with the researchers. And that's something that one of the presentations that really came out strongly for me was why women use or do not use the product. And some of these are gender issues that really face women at our level. And so as an advocate, there is need for us to call for more programs to address the gender issues, the cultural issues that affect women and would not use the products that the researchers are working hard to develop. Coming say that, I would really say that another opportunity for me was to meet individuals in fact that I've never had an opportunity to do that. I just read their work and, you know, like talking to Jared, and I think it's Dr. Jared, yes, yes. I was to talk to him face-to-face and ask him some questions was quite good for me to understand the issues around prep, how they feel different, somebody has, like, in India, we have a really, like, unique and innovative strategy to ensure that we reach the population at risk and in different geographical settings. Then understanding how we need to do that and also and also young women was self-identifying for me.
Great. Tricia, thank you so much, and I think you really highlighted that the conference did provide, I think, more than any meeting I've been to, I think possibly ever, a real community commons, a chance where anybody could ask anyone anything in a great deal of openness, and that was incredibly exciting. So thank you so much for that. I'm going to open up in just a second, but I think we're still trying to get Yvette, but I do want to turn for a moment to Kate Hankins. And Kate, if you want to hit star 7, it's been, it seems it seems an eternity ago, but now 7 years since you led the UNAIDS team working with us today back on developing the good participatory practice guidelines. And I wondered if you wanted to reflect as we think about both the complexities of the follow-on vaccine studies and the antibody research and what to do about PrEP, if you wanted to reflect just for a minute on where GPP fits within that and how it was framed as part of the conference.
Well, I really, really enjoyed the GPP components of the conference. I do want to mention right off the top the launch of the online training program that's been developed with the Center for Learning and Innovation, San Francisco Department of Public Health. I've had nothing to do with it, but it looks like a really exciting program. And that was, I think, Stacey Hanna and Jonathan Poops. And then I chaired a session with Stacey that was really quite interesting because we saw some of the problems, some of the challenges, for example, with trying to practice GPP in Kenya with LGBT communities and the difficulties in rights-constrained environments of putting into practice GPP principles. We saw some fascinating things of the use of GPP, for example, in CAPRISA 008, which is the post-trial study. How do you determine what is a reasonable level of compensation to participants for their travel and for their time and so on. And we saw, you know, HVTN 073, there was a community consultation that was conducted that actually changed the whole social marketing strategy of the program. But I guess the example that was that just really stood out as being quite extraordinary was FACS 001 that had a full-time GPP manager that was part of the core management group for the trial, and GPP procedures are integrated right into the manual for the conduct of the trial. And I'll just finish by saying a very interesting presentation on, it was from the HVTN Transgender Working Group, and it really got me thinking about the challenges for transgendered people of participating in trials. And I think it's worth following up with them, anybody that's interested in this topic, because they had a number of recommendations and a real sensitivity, both in terms of language and in terms of the environment, how you structure things such as even gender-neutral bathrooms and toilets, et cetera. So I'll just say I just felt, you know, we asked for a long, long time that that people document what they were doing with GPP and that they report it, and we finally seem to have now a wealth of information coming through on how this is working to improve trial conduct.
Great. Kate, thank you so much. And the launch of the GPP course, just so folks know, was not part of the webcast, but is available on the website. And again, we'll send the links there. And for those of you who haven't had a chance, the whole good participatory practice guideline development and the tools has really emerged over the last 7 years out of challenging times. And I think, as Kate says, this conference was the first where it was actually being put into practice, not by UNAIDS or by AVAC, but by research groups and trial sites themselves, which is what it was always intended to be. So that's a great overview of a number of different issues. I think perhaps now maybe just open it up to people if you have questions about those, or for those of you who were there, what have we missed? What would you recommend to those who weren't there to pay attention to? So if you'd like *7 to unmute your line, please introduce yourself. Be brief, but please ask questions or make comments.
Mitchell, it's Sheena here. Can I make comment?
Sure.
It's just that it just is making me think a little bit that I also came away a tiny bit from the conference thinking there was a little bit of reinventing the wheel going on. And I just thought, I mean, I don't want to undermine GPP and what it's achieved at all. It's given people a toolkit who are starting a new, in a new area, a new geographic area or whatever. But this is not to say that these activities did not go on for many, many years. All of the large network trials have had activities going on to engage communities. They might have called them different words, community liaison officers or whatever in centres. But these community engagement activities are part and parcel of the massive HIV prevention trials because you're looking for people who are not patients. So it's a very different approach. You have to have large community engagement going on and do your best to engage the community, the end users, in the design of your studies and the details of the conduct of them. So I think GPP is fantastic. It really helps, but much of it draws on examples of practices that were already well underway.
Oh, a great point, Gina, and it was always the intention to capture that and not to say it had never been done. So it was a great, great point. Other questions or comments from the conference? And I'll also invite people, this was a grand experiment that was high risk, I think, as Robin Shattuck described in his closing. So also any comments for thinking ahead to the future of what did work and also what didn't work. But anyway, I'll open it up there. So *7 to unmute yourself if you'd like to add anything. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. It's Yvette from South Africa. I hope you can hear me.
Oh, hello, Yvette. You made it.
Yes, I'm sorry. I think the time difference was a little bit of a problem. I think just comments on the conference. I think it was a great conference, but as I was part of the young women's group that was at the conference, I think most of all, I think it's just an observation that a lot of the young women felt that they were missing at the sessions, the young women's voices, as were missing at the conference with plenary, at some of the sessions, and that is just the overall feeling that the young women's voices were not heard. I don't know if everyone feels the same way or has some kind of an explanation for that.
It's a great point, Yvette, and I wanted not to, I think, maybe, I don't know if Emma Pola or Bill, you're on the line, Emma Pola Manrique and Bill Snow from the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise, in perhaps describing some of the challenges of managing a large scientific meeting, but that's also trying to engage a range of communities. And I don't know, Bill or Emma Pola, are you on and want to say anything?
Sure, Mitchell. It's Bill.
Hey, Bill.
I agree that the issue of young women is a huge high priority and that we probably need to give it more attention as we go on, just as we need to do with other key populations. The way the program gets set up is actually somewhat out of our hands. We have co-chairs who are chosen and who work with the program organizing committee. And there's really only a few ways that people can get an opportunity to sit at the table and speak. One is to be invited to a non-abstract driven session, which the organizing committee did its best to generate as much diversity as it can. This is largely meant to be a scientific meeting, so. So it was basically in the plenaries that we had the opportunity to give those big picture presentations. And then the other way is by submitting abstracts. And I will say that we would have loved to have gotten better and more high-scoring abstracts from people who do advocacy and community work, because we had a really hard time finding ones that we could put into that were good enough to put into posters and compete with some of the other work that's being done.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Bill. And Yvette, you know, really, both the question and Bill's your answer is a really important one. And I think it highlights, as we all think ahead, not only to the R4P 2016 meeting, but I think the ability to support a whole range of individuals with abstract development so that they really do capture both the true voices but also can work their way through a scoring process. And that means probably thinking about how abstracts are scored and reviewed, but also perhaps providing mentorship to make sure those kinds of abstracts do find their way in. And again, I know that the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise as the conference secretariat and the 2016 conference chairs that were announced at the end of the meeting last week are really committed to hearing from people, just as Yvette just described, of what could be done differently and better going forward. So I think this issue of perhaps an abstract mentorship effort and really supporting that is a great takeaway. Other questions and comments from anyone on the line? Again, *7 to unmute yourself.
This is Emily from AVAC. I guess just in the spirit of sort of thinking ahead to the next conference and in line with this this particular conversation, I think that training or working on abstract mentorship is great. I think that we should also mentor scientists who are presenting to figure out how to do the slide or two at the beginning or the end that says what the key take-home messages are And then also perhaps, especially, Theresia in one session sparked a really interesting conversation that was not expected, I think, from the folks in the room, was a cure and early infection session instead of your gender disaggregated by data, or your data disaggregated by gender. So I think just to acknowledge that again, we're not reinventing the wheel here, and many of us live and work on this translational frontier of speaking science clearly and explaining our advocacy priorities, but that it would be really great to have a priority for all of the plenary speakers and for scientists in general to be thinking about the fact that this conference has a diverse array of participants, all of whom want to really get the punchline.
Yeah, a great, great point, Emily. Other questions, comments, or also if those of you who were there, things that you would want those not there to know about and perhaps go back to webcast for sessions that really sparked your interest?
From the HBTN. I just want to point out one other really, really wonderful feature of this conference, and that is there were a number of people who submitted their science via posters. And those posters are also available online. When you go to the HIVR50 website, if you'll scroll down to the little picture that says e-posters, it takes you to an e-posters online, a feature that's searchable, and you can actually view most of the posters. Most of the authors submitted their posters, and you can see both the science in terms of their methodology, the data that they presented. Over 500 posters there, and some really important sciences organized by theme. And, for me, I was worried that the U.S. epidemic would be ignored since we were in Africa. And there's some great work there, and you can find that both in the posters and the oral session. And there was a great presentation from James McIntyre in a session on Tuesday called the session was Safer Sex in 2014 as a Paradigm Shifted. And his poster is What is Safer Sex in 2014? Understanding the Biology of HIV Prevention, where he gives a history of the changes we've been through. So I would encourage people to look at both of those areas, the posters and that particular presentation as well.
Great, great point, Wakefield. It's really a treasure trove online, and it's a great way to be sure whether you were there or not that this was not a four-day meeting and done. It was 4 days within a much larger context, and all of this material is super, super helpful. So thank you for that. And again, we'll send that link around so everybody can find it very easily. Other questions, comments? Reflections, anything at all?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi, it's Thomas Hagen, Montreal. I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes, very clearly.
Yeah. Yeah, this is maybe a very superficial observation, but I was wondering, it seems like the concept of combination prevention is not sort of very present in the conversations and the discussions, and I'm wondering if this is something that's maybe fallen off the radar a bit, partly because I think here in our context in Montreal, it's sort of a concept that's really taken on some momentum, particularly in terms of community mobilization.
Yeah, Thomas, it's a great point, and I'll let others respond as well. I think it was implicit and actually explicit throughout, and in fact, early in the conversations around developing this conference as a combined meeting of a number of fields, there was talk about, you know, should the combination prevention be highlighted in its name itself? And there was a sense that while there is an enormous amount of work about high-impact combination prevention strategies, that the term can often be misleading and confusing to people, so that it was not used as the moniker for the conference. But I think it was one of the themes, beginning all the way at the very outset of the opening session with Tony Fauci from NIH, all the way through, this idea was there, and it's really a fascinating and important observation for someone from you that it didn't seem to be there, because I think on the ground it was very much at the heart of it. But I don't know if Bill or Kate or any of you want to answer that as well.
I guess part of the question is coming, I mean, EPIR, there was a study site here in Montreal, as you perhaps know, and I think, especially from a community perspective, part of the interest in EPIRG was within a broader framework of how this potential tool can be combined with others, including HIV testing and things that I think sometimes also maybe fall a little bit off the radar because they're not so much of a kind of seen as a breakthrough. But so I think maybe this is part of the. I think I'd be interested in knowing more about how. The ways in which combination prevention can be misunderstood might be helpful in our context, among other places, because I think, especially from a community perspective, that's part of the interest in PrEP is how it fits into other strategies.
Thomas, it's a great point, and I just want to refer back also. Wakefield mentioned Alex Katina's closing plenary address, and he put up a fascinating slide from the Partners PrEP study within Sierra Discordant Couples in Kenya and Uganda. And we often look at the comparison between the active PrEP arm and the placebo arm, where we saw this almost 70% reduction. But he added in the background incidence amongst Sierra Discordant couples in those two countries with nothing at all. And it showed very clearly that the placebo group, who didn't do nearly as well as the PrEP group, still through the combination package provided to them, and we've seen this in many other clinical trials, was very clearly success even without the addition of PrEP. And it's just this question of adding as we go. And so Alex's presentation, I think, is a great one to see that. But your point is spot on and a critical one.
Mitchell?
Yes. Go ahead, Emma Paula.
So I just wanted to ask that I think, you know, the thought of combination prevention is something that is in the minds of people, especially when thinking about vaccine trials and you know, the success of PrEP and not having vaccines that are 100% efficacious. So we did have a symposium on the first day on Tuesday in the afternoon on building combination prevention trials, and the purpose of that session was really to look at what are the opportunities and the challenges. So I think that's probably, you know, the session that focused the most on that. But there were some results of, you know, preliminary monkey studies, mainly from Robin Shaddock's group, about combination trials and vaccines and microbes, looking at vaccine and microbicides together. So I think, I mean, why it might not be as highlighted as it is in people's minds, social plans is only starting to come out, and results are not there quite there yet. But I do think it's something that, you know, will shape the future trials, and people are kind of thinking about it, even though it might have been discussed as implicitly. Sorry.
Could I pick up on that? Because I was thinking, as Thomas is raising that point about the really broad context in which we want to add HIV prevention, which I think is a broad social context. I'd go beyond even HIV testing to talk about mental health and psychosocial support that is so often needed by many of these populations vulnerable to HIV infection. And I think Thomas is absolutely right that this is an exciting thing about PrEP, that we can embed it in a much of social movement to support people and prevent a range of things, not just HIV. But I wanted to ask specifically about that because one of the things there was a little bit less of in this conference compared to the usual microbicides conference, what were the kind of social behavioral oral presentations. And I think Bill made a point about the standard of the advocacy abstracts, but what about the social and behavioral science abstracts? Is there a need for us to try and help strengthen some of those as well to get this broader picture in which we're trying to sort of combine prevention tools and make them work in implementation. Can anybody comment on that?
Yeah, this is Kate here. This is Kate here. I would agree with you, Gina. And I think, furthermore, I think the broader concept of combination prevention beyond, you know, combination biomedical prevention tools, but looking at the broader research field that's going on in HIV prevention would be good. So we didn't really hear anything about some of the structural trials that are going forward with social grants and conditional cash transfers. We need to be looking at the broader psychosocial context, but also the determinants of HIV risk and how these biomedical tools can best approach.
No, thank you both. I think that's a really important point. I think there were, you know, a number of sessions, both non-abstract and perhaps less on the abstract side. And again, I think it's a question of how they were scored. The committee was quite broad and diverse, but I think does highlight that as we think about 2016, to ensure that multiple voices are engaged in the very broadest possible sense of issues that are critical to all of these fields. Other questions, comments before we – I realize we're just past the top of the hour. Anything else burning and yearning from anybody on the line, either from Cape Town or who wasn't there? All right. Well, as we said, this was not at all the end punctuation to the meeting last week. It really is simply a comma in a continued conversation that will take us all forward. Again, on this last slide, if you're still on the ReadyTalk, you'll see the webcast, the What's Up HIV blog, which has a really remarkable diversity of perspectives from advocates, researchers, journalists, talking about all sorts of issues. The daily summaries you'll see there, an archive around the social media with that hashtag. All of the abstracts are online, and you have the link here. And I failed to put up in Wakefield. Thank you so much for reminding us of the e-posters, where you can actually see the actual posters and be in touch with the authors if you're interested in following up. And we'll add that to this link before this goes on the website as an archive. And then various media clips have been assembled by the HIV-R4P team in the news section there. And perhaps most importantly, think ahead. And 17 to 21 October in the Windy City of Chicago, Illinois, in the United States, will be home to the second ever HIV-R4P conference. And I know that everyone will want to think hard about how, although I think generally we all would say the first ever R4P was, I think, a great success, how do we ensure 2016 is as great or better still? So please do send questions, comments. Feel free to use avac@avac.org. We will be sure to liaise with Bill and Amapola and the conference secretariat. And we look forward to many more conversations about what to do with all this evolving information. So thanks, everybody, and have great evenings and afternoons and mornings on the West Coast still.